Well, hello. Thank you for bobbing in. I should probably introduce myself. I am the ghost of Emily Bronte, as unlikely as that sounds. Go with it. Yes, I am communing with you from the other side because I'd like to welcome you to a special episode of the Failing Writers podcast that, I've got my fingers crossed, will be a really good one. Got very high expectations of this one. Reckon it should be a bit of a banger. I mean, just in terms of probability. There's got to be one eventually, hasn't there?
The Brontes.
Who were they?
Where were they?
What did they do?
How did they become such titans of the late Romantic age of literature?
And why are they still so very, very revered?
We, the Failing Writers podcast, are trying to get to the bottom,
or more accurately, to the top,
of their enduring literary legacy.
To try and figure out what it is about these three daughters of a single parenting parson from a small remote town on a steep hill in Yorkshire that appeals to so many readers across the world.
Even today, over 160 years since the three sisters' tragically young deaths.
Yes, we're going on kind of a Yorkshire pilgrimage across this anointed countryside. Over Dale.
Through Dingle.
Up Cloughs.
What is a clough?
I don't know, is it like a valley or something?
I don't know.
Around dells and down vaguely disappointing waterfalls.
All in search of
the full Bronte.
Now, we can't guarantee we'll find what we, or even you, are looking for.
But we'll have a reet good laugh along the way. And who knows, we might even learn something.
That's not normally how these documentaries of ours really work, is it?
Come on now, John. I think you're being a bit harsh on yourself there.
No, I was including you in that, Tom.
So,
this is another of our slightly odd little rambly documentaries. But regardless, we'll do our best to leave you with a little dusting of inspiration.
Maybe a nice glowy feeling just in your lower intestine.
And another couple of books to add to your reading list.
Oh, God. Seriously?
Right, shall we?
Let's.
Onwards.
Oh, and there he goes. Hang on, John. Wait for me. I'm coming.
And so, off they go along the Worth Valley towards the majestic Bronte Falls. Then up into the bleak beauty of the vast purple moors, towards Top Withens, a place close to my heart. A small dwelling sitting high, grim and haughty above the dale, like the king of the mountain. Come on, let's listen in on Tom and John, see if they're saying out interesting.
So, do you want to hear my ill-informed thinking on the Bronte sisters, Tommy?
I have to admit to not knowing that much about them, and this is going to shock you, to your very core. I've never read any of their work.
Not a single one, not even Jane Eyre.
No, I haven't read any of her stuff either.
So is that, are you going to add that to your reading list now, Tom?
It's not.
How about, this sometimes is how I get the kids to read a little bit. How about you read the first two chapters?
Yeah.
And see what you think.
No, I should. What would you recommend?
I think you've got to go Jane Eyre. Read the first three chapters.
It's gone up to three.
Yeah, but that's right, isn't it? That's what you have to read.
Yeah.
You know, if you're an agent or whatever.
Yeah.
So three chapters, Jane Eyre.
Okay.
See what you think. Haven't read Jane Eyre for quite a long time, but it is good. Yeah, so I think of Charlotte as being quite ambitious. You know, she's the eldest. She's more driven than the others. So she's a bit more positive.
Yeah.
But passionate. Emily, a little bit more maudlin, a lot more maudlin. Very private, but still very passionate. And I think when Wuthering Heights came out, it just utterly baffled the critics. People hadn't really read anything like that before. And a lot of people took umbrage and thought it was a disgrace, you know, the things she was writing about. Because, you know, they didn't follow the sort of Victorian moral values of the day.
Yeah.
But I think people quite liked it for that reason as well.
Of course they did. They always do, don't they?
Yeah.
And it'd be the ones shouting loudest about it who would have a copy secreted about their bedchamber.
I think you're right. Kissing gate, Tom.
It's more to do with it. Yeah, it doesn't... Unnecessary. Did they? We should be asking these. We should find someone that knows about these things.
Yeah, we probably should. Yeah, rather than me just waffling about stuff like that.
Did they write under their own names, or did they write as men?
They did write as men initially. Yeah.
Yeah, because that was the thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, they were the Bell brothers.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. No, I know that Anne was Acton.
Right.
And Charlotte was Charlie Bell.
Charlie Bell. Okay.
That's not true, listeners, by the way.
Never worked that out.
Yeah. Currer. Currer Bell.
Was it?
Yeah, just remembered.
Well, hopefully we'll go and speak to someone who knows something.
Yeah, let's do that. But I think they did, they came clean.
Right.
And people found out. Obviously, people were...
I mean, once it was popular, once...
Yeah, that's right. Once the books had
then you can
made their mark. Actually. What a shock that must have been, hey? Back in the day. Yeah, that would have been big news, wouldn't it?
Rumour spreading round.
Yeah, so Anne, finally. Mm. I think the impression you get from Anne is that she was the very upstanding, moral... I think she was a little bit more sort of Victorian, maybe, in her attitudes.
Right, OK.
If that makes sense.
A bit more straight-laced.
I think so, yeah.
I see what Tom meant now. That wasn't the most comprehensive insight into us, was it? Lucky for you, though, this episode won't be just John spouting the tiny amount he thinks he knows about us. They've also got some proper experts. Isn't that a relief? But before we invite said Bronte authorities to douse you with their knowledge, let's hear John doing a little quiz for Tom, just to check if he's paying attention. Where, incidentally, the cable for the microphone thingy was too short, so John had to hold it very close to his... delicates.
Would it be weird if you held a mic? would that feel a bit weird? You're not happy with that, are you? Okay, we can do this.
You have two hands.
Can you just hold it for a second? Okay. Right, Tom. Tommy, do you want a quiz?
What?
A little quiz.
What? We're having fun.
We are having fun, Tom.
I thought we were just we're out on a walk.
We're having a massive amount of fun.
What's the quiz about?
The quiz is...
Don't say the Brontes.
Of course it's about the Brontes.
I don't know anything about the Brontes.
I've just told you some stuff about the Brontes.
Is that in the quiz?
That's part of it.
Right, all right. Well, I'll...
Okay, so have you digested that information that I gave you earlier?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Completely.
All right, brilliant. So I'm going to read your poem.
Oh, okay.
And you got to guess who wrote the poem.
Which Bronte. Okay.
Yeah? Life, believe, is not a dream, so dark as sages say. Oft a little morning rain foretells a pleasant day. Sometimes there are clouds of gloom, but these are transient all. If the shower will make the roses bloom, oh, why lament its fall? Rapidly, merrily, life's sunny hours flip by. Gratefully, cheerily, enjoy them as they fly. What though death at times steps in and calls our best away? What though sorrow seems to win o'er hope a heavy sway? Yet hope again elastic springs, unconquered though she fell. Still buoyant are her golden wings, still strong to bear us well. I think that's the end.
I kept
not the end.
Thinking it was the end, and then it's not the end.
Hang on. Manfully, fearlessly, the day of trial bear, for gloriously, victoriously, can courage quell despair.
Is that the end?
That's the end.
Right. From what you said earlier, that sounds like an Emily. Was she one of the Brontes?
Yeah. She was one of the Brontes, yeah.
I'm going to go for Emily because it doesn't sound too morose. Like she's looking on the bright side of things. Do you know what I mean?
So it's Emily.
It might be raining, but it could be a good day.
So it's Emily at her most positive, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
On a good day?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, I'll read you another one.
What's the answer? Do I not get to know the answer?
That was Charlotte.
I thought you said she was dead miserable.
No, that's Emily.
Oh, right, I meant Charlotte then.
Okay, yeah, you're right.
Yes.
Okay, who's this? She dried her tears and they did smile to see her cheeks returning glow, nor did discern how all the while that full heart throbbed to overflow. With that sweet look and lively tone and bright eye shining all the day, they could not guess at midnight lone, how she would weep the time away.
Ugh, God. Is that Emily?
That's Emily,
yeah. Oh, come on, Emily.
Yeah.
Chin up.
She's giving the impression there that actually she was... Well, hang on, we missed a turning.
Probably, because some idiot thought it would be good to do a quiz.
How do we miss a turn?
There aren't any turnings.
Oh my. Well, that's why I'm a bit confused. Oh, it's in there. Hang on. Oh, it's coming up. We're good.
Round this corner then.
Yeah. Bosh.
Okay. Well, that was fun. I enjoyed that.
Hang on, we're not done. There's Anne. It's not, obviously the next one's Anne.
Is the next one Anne?
We still need to hear it. Well, how about this one? The night is darkening round me. The wild winds coldly blow. But a tyrant spell has bound me. And I cannot go. The giant trees are bending. Their bare boughs weighed with snow. The storm is fast descending. And yet I cannot go. Clouds beyond. Clouds above me. Wastes beyond wastes below. But nothing drear can move me. I will not, cannot go.
I mean, I think that's probably Anne. Sounds like Anne.
No, that was a trick one.
Oh, it wasn't
Anne. So who was it if it wasn't Anne?
Barnaby. Was that the brother?
Bramwell.
Bramwell, that's the one.
No, it wasn't Barnaby. No. That was actually Emily again.
Right.
It was just a little tricksy one.
Right.
Finally.
Oh, that means there's another one now.
Can I just actually, before I read another one.
You are exactly the kind of person that would walk along the Bronte Trail reading Bronte poetry out loud, by the way. And I don't mean that in a kind way.
No. No, I mean, that's a fair comment. I accept it.
I think you would be doing this whether I was here or not. Probably louder.
I've got some comments from readers online.
Yeah.
Who've read that last poem that I read you.
Right.
You want to hear them?
Yeah, go on then.
Some comments from readers online. Firstly, this poem is called Spellbound, someone's put.
Right.
They were just letting us know because the title wasn't on there.
Okay, well.
So that's nice.
That's good to know, isn't it?
Yeah. I believe that the poem is based on the idea of a mother having to leave her child to die on a winter hilltop.
Wow.
The refrain, cannot go, shows her reluctance to leave her baby.
Right.
Tragically beautiful. The woman is under a spell and finds herself unable to walk away. And then at the end, what I like, the best comment of all is, there is, however, no reference to a child in the poem.
Well, that's what poetry's about, isn't it?
Okay. The next one. I believe Emile brings the human mind under the scope as she focuses on addiction.
Right.
I love how people bring their own things
to
poetry.
Again, that's...
The addict attempts to convince herself that escape is impossible as to avoid the perilous journey towards salvation. Yeah?
Yeah.
And then someone has just simply put, the poem is about the darkening night and the poet is talking about what is happening around her.
Oh, we've got a literal interpretation yeah. there.
But I think my favourite one. This poem is about the protagonist being violated by a tree fairy and a squirrel. She then decides that she will eat the magic mushrooms and freeze the wandering Mickey.
Okay. I think they brought their own ideas to the party there, haven't they?
So, yeah, four very different interpretations
yeah.
of the same poem.
Can't help imagining the Bronte household of them just sat by dim candlelight upon an evening, just constantly writing poems.
Yeah, in tiny writing.
And then reading them to each other. And do you think they were, like, supportive of each other? Like we are in the failing writers.
Yeah, like fake supportive.
Or do you think they were...
Whilst really being a little bit jealous.
Or were they kind of like, oh, yeah, well... I probably wouldn't have ended with that line, Emily. But, you know, you do you.
Yeah. Same Dad, old you.
Anne's saying my poetry's shit again.
Anyway, we haven't read Anne's. I need to read Anne's.
Do we?
Yep.
It'll just sound the same as the others, won't it?
A bit miserable.
Ooh, the moors, the cold wind.
She's up.
My empty heart.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Okay, yeah, you kind of nailed it, yeah. Well, this one is about...
Where's this tea shop you said we were going to get to?
It was shut.
Right. That was a long time ago. You said, let's go and get tea and cake.
Yeah. I don't know if you noticed, but the town that we passed through didn't have a cake shop.
No. Right, do you want to read Anne's poem? Cheer me up.
It's not a very cheery one, this one, Tom. She's the devout.
Fun times.
The devout
brilliant.
One. Yeah. So this is about...
So not fun and loose like the last two with their poems.
No.
None of that hilarity.
So there was a young curate.
You can keep talking a bit longer. There's a chance I might get run over by this Land Rover. And a little bit of luck.
He was called William Waitman, and he was like the attractive young assistant curate of the parish.
Right, okay.
Of course, potentially quite a catch as well. And the suspicion is that Anne was in love with this guy because there are letters that Charlotte wrote saying how they were kind of looking at each other in church in sexy ways.
Oh,
she didn't
what?
Phrase it like that. I'm paraphrasing. But he died quite young, obviously before she did.
Right.
And so this is about...
Oh, brilliant. The death of a
the death of someone she was in love with. Yes, thou art gone, and nevermore thy sunny smile shall gladden me. But I may pass the old church door and pace the floor that covers thee. May stand upon the cold, damp stone and think that frozen lies below the lightest heart that I have known, the kindest I shall ever know. Yet, though I cannot see thee more, 'tis still a comfort to have seen, and though thy transient life is o'er, 'tis sweet to think that thou hast been. To think a soul so near divine, within a form so angel fair, united to a heart like thine, has gladdened once our humble sphere.
Quite good, that one, actually.
It's quite moving, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite nice, that.
Sometimes it helps to kind of roughly know what it's about, as in, good to know the story behind things. Look, a little wren.
You stop it with the birds. People aren't tuning in for bird watching.
They can't see them either, can they?
No, you could. Oh, look, there's an emu. Whatever you want, no one knows. Do you think, were there any poems around that time that actually wrote the word over out in full without an apostrophe?
No.
Is it like the law?
It is. It's like a poetic law, isn't it?
Top Withins? Bronte yep. Falls.
Bronte Falls first.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely time for one of those experts I mentioned earlier. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Well, here is the brilliant Lucasta Miller, who wrote a book debunking all the silly stories about us called The Bronte Myth. I recommend it. It's excellent.
I mean, for me, I think it was Jane Eyre that did it. Oh, I think the critic G.H. Lewis, who was one of its first reviewers, talked about, you know, the way in which it just pulls you straight into the mind of the character to the extent that we feel we almost are her. And I remember, I read it as a child, and then later on when I was trying to do an incredibly over-abstract PhD on the theories of language in Milton, I used to just read and reread Jane Eyre as comfort reading. And then I suddenly realised that, why should I be studying something that's driving me nuts? Why shouldn't I study something that I actually really love? However, looking at it in the longer historical perspective, I think that there are sort of different reasons at different points in history why the Brontes have grabbed people. And there's one really sort of basic thing that makes them almost feel like fairy tale characters, the idea of these three sisters, that sort of magical number three. I mean, I think Ted Hughes at one point calls them the three weird sisters, as if they've got some sort of, you know, witchy power. I mean, it is really unusual to have three quite so talented writers in one family. I think they encouraged and supported each other a lot, which was important. We've also got to remember that they really did have one failing writer in the family too, their brother, Branwell, who did in fact publish a few poems in local newspapers, but, you know, tragically came to a rather sticky end.
Yeah. Did he ever attempt to write novels aside from the sort of juvenilia stuff?
He did try to write a novel, but it by that time he was completely addicted to alcohol. He also took opium, and, you know, he really wasn't up to writing a sustained narrative. I think the fact that the sisters were women, of course, it meant that in some ways their lives were more constrained. On the other hand, because they sort of had to do the housework and go out as governesses and do all this other stuff, they didn't really have the opportunity to try and become the sort of romantic rebel, the Byronic hero. And so, you know, Branwell has much more leeway to go and basically self-destruct.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Charlotte in particular was ambitious to be a famous published writer before she was 21. She's actually so confident that she writes to the poet laureate, Robert Southey, confessing her desire to be forever known as a poetess. It's not that there weren't any women writers writing in the early 19th century. And one of the women writers whose work that the Brontes would have read in these anthologies was a poet called Letitia Landon, who published under her initials L-E-L. She ended up being found dead with a bottle of prussic acid in her hand in 1838. Charlotte Bronte wouldn't necessarily have known the sleazy backstory, but she did know that there were famous women writers. However, when the Brontes came to publish, they decided to use pseudonyms because they correctly believed that critics were prejudiced against women writers. One of the most vituperative reviews of Jane Eyre that was published in the Quarterly Review was, in fact, by a woman called Elizabeth Rigby. Now, Elizabeth Rigby attacks Jane Eyre for being immoral, for being and all these other things, which other people also attack Jane Eyre for, partly because Jane has this very assertive character. But Elizabeth Rigby, you'd think that she would be criticising Jane Eyre on a socially conservative platform. But she's criticising Jane Eyre for the fact that she talks about the genuine real-life plight of governesses and basically says Jane Eyre's a masochist to want to have this love affair with this ghastly Mr. Rochester. And, you know, the real solution for the governess problem is for them to form a trade union and get better pay. The answer isn't for them to marry the master. So the feminist view of them that was popular in the 70s and does definitely have an element of truth was to see Charlotte Bronte as partly as sort of just as creating this assertive character of Jane Eyre, but also as seeing Charlotte herself as a sort of victim of patriarchy. But I realised that actually it's a lot more complicated than that. People have tried to find autobiographical elements in Wuthering Heights, but honestly, all those attempts to find a real life lover for Emily, they're really just conspiracy theories. Interestingly, when the books were first published, they came out under pseudonyms, so nobody knew who had written them. They didn't know anything about the authors. They were published under these male pseudonyms, Currer, Ellis and Acton Bell. And it was really in 1857, after Charlotte Bronte, in fact, after they'd all died, and they all died young, that Charlotte Bronte's friend, the writer Elizabeth Gaskell, who she'd only got to know in her later life, wrote a absolutely classic and in some ways earth-shattering biography called The Life of Charlotte Bronte. It's an absolutely wonderful read. Gaskell was a brilliant novelist herself, but it's also a little bit of 19th century spin because you've got to remember that at the time the books were first published, Victorians were very, very disturbed by all this, and Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights got a reputation for being immoral, for being what the Victorians called coarse. And so Charlotte Bronte's image at the time she died was quite complicated. And what Elizabeth Gaskell wanted to do, it was like she felt, you know, if anybody knows what sad lives these poor women really led, they will forgive them for writing their immoral, coarse, dodgy books. And one reader, Charles Kingsley, said to Gaskell something, "Well, have you done your work and given us a woman made perfect by sufferings?" You know, I had dismissed Charlotte Bronte as a woman who wrote coarse books. So it completely changed the image of the Bronte sisters overnight. And it also relocated the interest very much in the lives.
So in a way, she was trying to protect their reputations. But
yes, in a way she was. But even Mrs. Gaskell herself found Jane Eyre slightly dodgy. She wouldn't let her own daughter read it until she was grown up. She never met Emily Bronte and she didn't warm to what she heard of her. So we don't really get anything at all about the sort of inner life of Emily Bronte. She's just described in a couple of very vivid and melodramatic anecdotes, one of which she's beating her own bulldog into a pulp.
Wow.
So it's almost as if the Emily of the biography becomes like a character in Wuthering Heights.
And it's interesting, isn't it? The whole separating what is fact from myth. So even that close to their time, obviously there's people putting their own skew on things of what the girls were like.
Absolutely. And I think there are myths in the sense of sort of fake facts, like various attempts to find lovers for Emily. I mean, you know, there's a funny one where one biographer in the 1930s finds a manuscript of a poem by Emily, and above it is written this title in sort of slightly illegible pencil. And she realizes that it's got this name, Louis Parancel. Ah, that must have been Emily's secret lover. And it turns out she just wasn't very good at reading old handwriting, and it says Love's Farewell, and it's just the title of the poem. And okay, it's a love poem, but Emily Bronte invented this sort of fantasy world with her sister Anne called Gondel. And there's a lot of poetry that's written in the ventriloquized voices of all these characters. So, okay, you've got those fake facts on the one hand. On the other hand, you've got myths in the sense of the way in which people have read the evidence in slightly different ways in order to conform to, you know, whatever their viewpoint is at that particular moment in history. I mean, an example of that would be how, well, after Elizabeth Gaskell's biography was published, Charlotte Bronte became this sort of iconic figure as a sort of moral guide in books for girls about how to grow up to be a good woman. And what's so weird is that that was going on at the same time that Jane Eyre continued to have this slightly dodgy aura. Their father, he was himself, in fact, a published writer. He's a really interesting man. Came from an incredibly impoverished background in Ireland. I think his parents were illiterate, but he sort of went to the local village school, was bright, and ended up amazingly being sent to Cambridge, where in fact he changed his name to the name Bronte that we know today. Yes. He was originally called Brunty or Prunty, and he called himself Bronte because Nelson had recently been created the Duke of Bronte by the King of Naples. So, you know, you can see there's this very aspirational thing going on in their father, you know, long before they're born. He's himself a published writer. He's published some poetry, although it has to be said that one of his things was to invent what has been called the most irritating verse form ever created. I think it would appeal to you because I think you did a podcast about the history of limericks.
Yes. Yeah.
It was the serious limerick in which the last line deliberately didn't rhyme.
Oh, no, I hate him. Yeah, no.
Let me give you an example.
Oh, yes, please.
Religion makes beauty enchanting, and even where beauty is wanting, the temper and mind, religion refined, will shine through the veil with sweet luster.
Oh, you...
that's just so wrong.
Oh, to novels and plays not inclined, nor aught that can sully her mind, temptations may shower, unmoved as a tower. She quenches the fiery arrows.
What a horrible man.
Why would you do that?
What kind of...
I have no idea. I think that those were collected by John Julius Norwich in one of his brilliant little Christmas anthologies called The Christmas Cracker. But I don't want to laugh too much at Patrick Bronte because, you know, he was so extraordinary, so ambitious that he recreated himself from being an Irish peasant to being a sort of... the Church of England. You know, so the is important to particularly Charlotte Bronte because the fact that she managed to recreate herself as not just a published writer, but a bestseller, I think, you know, some of that came from the example of her father, even though he was not so quite so successful in the literary line.
There is a myth, and I can't actually remember where I heard it, but there's a story of a second Emily Bronte novel.
Yes.
Which was destroyed by Charlotte. Is there any truth, do we know? Is that just legend or is there any evidence for it?
No, there's definitely circumstantial evidence for that. There is a letter that I think was found in Emily's writing desk after she died from Emily's publisher to her discussing her second work and advising her to take time over her second work. So, you know, we're pretty sure that she certainly at least had the idea of writing a second novel after Wuthering Heights. The possibility that Charlotte destroyed it is quite strong because Charlotte's two sisters died in quick succession shortly after the three sisters had first published, and their brother also died within the same period. It was an unbelievably devastating series of bereavements. Mm. And eventually she started to look over her sister's papers and go through them again. And they both died of TB. Her sister Anne had died quite a sort of quiet, very brave and resigned Christian death. And Charlotte felt, well, I felt I could let Anne go to God. She felt Emily had not died that sort of death. She felt that Emily was torn panting out of a happy life and she wanted her back all the time. She was very, very disturbed and distressed. On the other hand, she knew that Emily was an absolutely singularly private person. Charlotte also, I think, felt uncomfortable about the fact that Emily had remained psychologically dependent on her secret fantasy world of Gondel, about which she'd written reams and reams and reams of stories. And there's no way Emily would have wanted anyone ever to read that Gondel prose. So I think the likelihood is, and no letters from Emily to Charlotte survive, even though there were long periods in which they were separated. Neither are there letters from Anne to Charlotte. So I think that Charlotte probably destroyed most of her, both her sisters' effects at this time in about 1850, when she was going through their papers. In fact, to prepare for publication, a second edition of Wuthering Heights and a few of both her sisters' poetic remains that she thought should be republished. She was quite a sort of interventionist editor. She changes quite a lot of words in Emily's poetry. All her life, she'd felt simultaneously that she felt very worried about Emily, that Emily sort of couldn't quite look after herself. On the other hand, she felt very blocked out by Emily and that Emily operated, as one outside observer put it, with an unconscious tyranny over Charlotte. So there's a little bit of a power struggle going on in the background. But what I really wouldn't do, which I think some people have done, is to demonize Charlotte as a result of this and say what a dreadful person she was if she indeed destroyed this manuscript along with other stuff. If she did so, I think that as biographers, our job is to understand possibly why, rather than simply to make judgments, because what's the point of writing biography if it's not about teasing out human nature? Mm. It's, of course, a great loss to posterity that we haven't got a sequel to Wuthering Heights, although who knows what stage it was at and how much Emily had written. But it would have been incredibly interesting because Emily Bronte remains a very, very enigmatic figure because we just don't have all this sort of other stuff that we have for Charlotte. So for Charlotte, we've got, I think it's 3 huge fat volumes of her correspondence in the modern edition. After her sisters died, she developed relationships with other well-known writers. So she was writing to them as well. And she had close friends who she wrote to throughout her life. Whereas Emily was genuinely incredibly reclusive. I mean, she doesn't seem to have made a single close friend outside her immediate family.
Wow. So this is partly why she's known as the Sphinx of literature, I'm guessing.
Absolutely.
She's just a puzzle.
Yes, and I think she does remain a genuine puzzle.
Well, thank goodness. Someone who actually knows what they're on about. Hopefully you've got a deeper understanding of us now. Right, I wonder where the boys are on their literary pilgrimage. Come on, let's have a look-see.
So what do you think Bronte Falls will be like, Tommy? What are you imagining?
Like a mini Niagara Falls, really.
Yeah. Right. Quite dramatic.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll be able to feel the spray soon, then.
Yeah,
here we are, Tommy.
What is it?
The Bronte Falls.
It's like a small leak. It's just like a...
It's nice, though, isn't it? It could lull you, that, couldn't it? Can you imagine lying here?
Why is it the Bronte Falls? Would they come and sit there and write miserable poetry type thing? And
yeah, I think so.
Reflect.
They would have spent a lot of time wandering around here, wouldn't they? And this would have been, I mean, almost certainly would have been a nice place. Having written some poetry, falling asleep, exhausted creatively.
Yeah, to the gentle trickle of the tiny little waterfall.
Yeah. Okay, here we go, Tommy. I think we've found the proper waterfall. I think that was just a precursor. That was like a little teaser.
The top of it, yeah.
Because look, there's lots of people down here. There's literally like a coach load of people. We suggest there's probably an easier way of getting here, Tom.
Yeah.
It is a lovely little spot, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
Well, every step brings them closer. They're approaching a steep climb now. Let's hope they have the fortitude to forge ahead instead of turning round and going to the pub like they did the last time they did one of these rambly episodes.
See that over there, Tommy?
The hill or the other hill?
The hill.
The tree.
The tree.
Under the tree.
Yeah.
That's Wuthering Heights. That's Top Withins.
Right.
That's Kate Bush's house.
Right.
Right. So we're not far now. Although something tells me that that looks closer than it is.
That's a good half mile away, isn't it?
Yeah.
Across a massive hill.
Yeah.
They're still going. Good on you, boys. Don't give up. Well, I think this is going surprisingly well. If only there was a bit more bird song in this episode. I love receiving tweets.
Are you recording bird noises?
Yeah, maybe.
Jesus.
Maybe. Well, I haven't heard a lapwing properly yet.
No one cares about the birds.
I think they do. It's all part of the experience, Tom. That's what you're missing. Oh, just plunges straight in the moors, that sound. Yeah. There's something in the air, isn't there, Tom? There's a kind of magic here. Some say that the ghost of Emily Bronte walks these moors.
Right.
She's been seen in her flowing garments.
Just being miserable.
Just mainly being miserable.
Just being a bit.
Sometimes with dogs, sometimes without.
The hounds of love.
That's right. It is. It's a special place.
Yeah.
You can see where the poetry comes from, I think. I think you sort of have to come here to appreciate what the Brontes are all about, really. Because there is something about the space.
Yeah, there is something, not depressing, but kind of melancholic about the landscape, isn't there? It's kind of beautiful, but it's kind of devoid of...
Yeah, I've got a brilliant quote that is exactly what we're talking about right now. It's just a tiny little quote from Wuthering Heights. In winter, nothing more dreary. In summer, nothing more divine than those glens shut in by hills and those bluff, bold swells of heath. Nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's true, it can be terrifying in the winter.
Yeah.
I don't think he's very happy about us being here, Tom.
What is it?
It's a lapwing.
An angry lapwing.
Yeah. He thinks we're going to eat his eggs.
I do.
You're hungry, Tom.
Might have a little
chow down on his eggs.
Making a mistake there, advertising the fact we've got some eggs going.
Miserable? I can't believe they just call me miserable. You'd be bloody miserable if you died at 30. Well, at least they're making some progress now. Hopefully they'll have arrived by the next clip.
Still look like we're about half a mile away. Still,
yeah.
It doesn't appear to be getting much closer. And that is actually a really big hill, isn't it, to climb up at the end?
No, I don't think it is that big. I think it's misleading, that.
Yeah,
that's an optical illusion.
And now it looks like it might actually rain.
Yeah.
Okay, not quite there yet. You won't believe it, but it's actually a dead easy little stroll up to Withens.
We've been walking for another 10 minutes now, I'd say.
Yeah.
And about half a mile away now?
Yeah, probably.
Which we thought we were previously.
Yeah.
It'll have like an ice cream parlour.
Oh, but hang on.
Coffee shop, won't it?
Oh, I'm sure it's got all that, yeah, because it has. When you look at that person over there, it doesn't make you realise they're really small.
So to people, I mean, obviously we know, but to people that maybe aren't that familiar with their works, what's the relevance of Top Withins?
So people reckon that Top Withins is Emily Bronte's inspiration for Wuthering Heights. So, do you know the story?
And again, I was going to say, there's maybe some people listening that don't know the story. It's bizarre, but really, think everyone would. But yeah. I mean, do you want to say about it?
Well, it is quite convoluted.
Yeah, it's convoluted, yeah.
You kind of need a family tree to fully understand it. But it starts, and I want you to imagine this, Tommy, now. It starts with a man who becomes a tenant of Thrushcross Grange, which is a house.
Do we need all the story, or? Because I was just asking about...
I'm building up to it. I'm giving you a bit of atmosphere,
right, okay,
Tom. Because it starts with him walking to
Wuthering Heights.
Wuthering Heights.
Right.
Yeah.
In our footsteps.
It's exactly in our footsteps. So he's walking from his house to have a chat with Heathcliff, who's obviously one of the main protagonists. And what we'll do here is just drop in a little quote, because it's quite a nice bit of the book. And I think what's special about it is that Emily was really good at local dialect. She had a good ear for how people spoke. And one of the characters, the help, the farmhand, Joseph, he's one of the characters that Mr. Lockwood first meets and has a confusing conversation with.
I took my hat and after a 4 miles walk, arrived at Heathcliff's garden gate, just in time to escape the first feathery flakes of a snow shower. On that bleak hilltop, the earth was hard with a black frost, and the air made me shiver through every limb. Being unable to remove the chain, I jumped over and, running up the flagged causeway bordered with straggling gooseberry bushes, knocked vainly for admittance till my knuckles tingled and the dogs howled. "Wretched inmates," I ejaculated mentally. "You deserve perpetual isolation from your species for your churlish inhospitality. At least I would not keep my doors barred in the daytime. I don't care, I will get in." So resolved, I grasped the latch and shook it vehemently. Vinegar-faced Joseph projected his head from a round window of the barn.
"What are you for?"
he shouted.
"T' maister's down it fold. Go around by end it lathe if you want to spatial him.
Is there nobody inside to open the door?"
I hallooed responsively.
"There's Norbert, missus, and she'll not open it. And you met your flare some din still neat."
"Why? Cannot you tell her who I am, eh, Joseph?"
"None of me. I want no end wi' it,"
muttered the head, vanishing. The snow began to drive thickly. I seized the handle to essay another trial when a young man without coat and shouldering a pitchfork appeared in the yard behind. He hailed me to follow him, and after marching through a wash house and a paved area containing a coal shed, pump, and pigeon cote, we at length arrived in the huge, warm, cheerful apartment where I was formerly received. It glowed delightfully in the radiance of an immense fire, compounded of coal, peat, and wood. And near the table, laid for a plentiful evening meal, I was pleased to observe the missus, an individual whose existence I had never previously suspected. I bowed and waited, thinking she would bid me take a seat. She looked at me, leaning back in her chair, and remained motionless and mute. "Rough weather," I remarked. "I'm afraid, Mrs. Heathcliff, the door must bear the consequence of your servant's leisure attendance. I had hard work to make them hear me." She never opened her mouth. I stared. She stared also. At any rate, she kept her eyes on me, in a cool, regardless manner, exceedingly embarrassing and disagreeable. "Sit down," said the young man gruffly. "He'll be in soon." I obeyed and hemmed and called the villain Juno, who deigned, at this second interview, to move the extreme tip of her tail in token of owning my acquaintance. "A beautiful animal," I commenced again. "Do you intend parting with the little ones, madam?" "They are not mine," said the amiable hostess, more repellingly than Heathcliff himself could have replied. "Ah, your favourites are among these," I continued, turning to an obscure cushion full of something like cats. "A strange choice of favourites," she observed scornfully. "Unluckily, it was a heap of dead rabbits." I hemmed once more and drew closer to the hearth, repeating my comment on the wildness of the evening. "You should not have come out," she said, rising and reaching from the chimney-piece two of the painted canisters. Her position before was sheltered from the light. Now I had a distinct view of her whole figure and countenance. She was slender and apparently scarcely past girlhood, an admirable form, and the most exquisite little face that I have ever had the pleasure of beholding. Small features, very fair, flaxen ringlets, or rather golden, hanging loose on her delicate neck, and eyes, had they been agreeable in expression, they would have been irresistible. Fortunately for my susceptible heart, the only sentiment they evinced hovered between scorn and a kind of desperation, singularly unnatural to be detected there. The canisters were almost out of her reach. I made a motion to aid her. She turned upon me as a miser might turn if anyone attempted to assist him in counting his gold. "I don't want your help," she snapped. "I can get them for myself." "I beg your pardon," I hastened to reply.
"Well, wasn't that nice? Tell you what, let's hear from our friend Lucaster Miller again, who, I have to say, is very insightful about the character of Lockwood.
Wuthering Heights is strange and interesting because although we see it as this great romantic novel, if you read it, the main action, you know, it's a tale within a tale. The narrator is this complete clot called Lockwood, the guy who intrudes on Wuthering Heights, stays the night there, and is so blind that he just literally can't understand what he sees before his eyes. You know, so Emily's actually telling us from the start, interpreting this novel is going to be a problem. Don't be like Lockwood. Mm. And actually, I think Emily's playing all sorts of games with things about how do we interpret what we read. But she doesn't give up her secrets. Wuthering Heights is sort of almost like a puzzle.
But yeah, the story is effectively about two lovers who end up marrying different people.
Of course it is.
And tearing themselves apart
Yeah.
because they know they've done the wrong thing. and it's not very funny.
Right.
The Brontes, they weren't like belly laughs. Yeah. But they're passionate, and that's what's wonderful about them. Intense emotions.
Oh, well. We can't be more than half a mile away now, then.
I'd say about half a mile, yeah. Roughly.
Bloody hell, they're dragging this out a bit, aren't they? I think they're just really slow walkers. Sorry about this.
Well, here we are, Tommy.
I'm no longer half a mile away.
No. These are the ruins of Top Withens, one of a cluster of farmhouses situated in the midst of Yorkshire moorland overlooking Howarth, Tommy. This remote spot is closely associated with the Brontes, as Top Withens is often cited as the inspiration for the setting of Emily Bronte's 1847 novel, Wuthering Heights. Although there are other buildings in the area that fit the description of Heathcliff's home more closely, Top Withens and the views from it encapsulate the landscape that inspired the Brontes' writing and continues to be a place of pilgrimage for visitors from all over the world. Hello. Excuse me, are you a Brontephile?
I know a little bit about them, not very much though.
We're recording for a podcast, by the way.
Oh, by a podcast?
I need to just admit that. That's what that is. That's not an ice cream.
Okay. So. I first came up here on a school trip when I was 17.
Oh, really?
And okay. I've been coming back ever since. I just love the place. It's one of my favourite novels.
It is wonderful, isn't it?
Wuthering Heights.
Oh, is? Yeah. Oh, okay. So you are a proper Brontephile.
Oh, not really. Not really. Not.
Well, if it's one of your favourite novels. I think that.
Yeah, but I don't know ins and outs. I mean, everything about it and where they live.
What do you like about it?
It's so ruggedly beautiful, the landscape here, and so is the novel. The novel is a really earthy story. It doesn't sugarcoat it. It's not an Austen. It's not everybody lives happily ever after, because they don't. And I just love how rugged it is.
Yeah, yeah. It is.
It's a bit like thorny bits of a rose. It's not the petals you appreciate, it's the thorns. It's the resilience
That's
of it.
Good, I like that. What's your name?
I'm Sam.
We'll get rid of that and pretend that we came up with that.
That's a great idea.
But yeah, I love it here. I come up here all the time. Well, not all the time. I live in Cheshire, so it's a bit of a hike. But
So you just come over for the week, just for the day?
Yeah, I just got up this morning.
Oh, nice.
I thought, you know what? It's time to go to Top Withens again. Yeah, I just left the kids in bed and I left a note. Gone to Howarth, back this evening. Yeah. Cook your own dinner.
For my mental health.
She's
having one of those days.
Yeah.
Well,
stay clear, let her go.
Sam's gone to Howarth. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? It's one of the two.
Great. Well, you seem very happy now, anyway.
Oh, I do, I love it. Any weather, I've been hearing just about every weather going, so definitely recommend it.
Brilliant. Thank you, Sam. Enjoy. Lovely to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Take care.
See ya.
Should we go in, Tom? It's cosy.
Right, so just to clarify.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say.
We've walked up this massive hill.
Yeah.
To stand in something that looks like a dry stone wall.
Like a big
public convenience. Yeah. And then it says on the official sign, oh, by the way, there's other buildings that fit the description better. This probably is another one, but
But look at it, Tom. Look at it, like, nestled under that tree. It feels like Wuthering Heights. It's got the right vibes. In fact, look, they wouldn't have done that, would they? They wouldn't have put a plaque on it.
Well, that's where she got the idea from then, isn't it? If that's been there.
Yeah, that's a 1964 plaque.
This plaque has been placed here in response to many inquiries.
Well, now you know. But people forget that writers do use their imaginations.
Yeah, where it says the buildings, even when complete, bore no resemblance to the house she described.
Yeah, but the situation may have been in her mind when she wrote about it. And it feels right. Oh, it's a story of hardship, Tommy. Top Withens.
I think estate agents would describe it as in need of modernisation, wouldn't they?
It was occupied and farmed until the early 1890s. There were people here. You can imagine this place getting struck by lightning a lot, can't you?
Yeah, I mean, it would be more pleasant with a roof.
Yeah.
As in that old photograph there.
But it was obviously been here a long time, since the 1500s.
Right, should we get the sandwiches out then?
No, let's get to the pub. Okay. Speed walk to the pub. It's downhill. Be there in no time.
Yeah. Well, finally, they've actually made it. I reckon now the boys have arrived at my beloved Wuthering Heights, it might be a good time to introduce the next guest. He's a professor of romantic literature, so like Lucaster, he too knows his onions. It's Dr. Gregory Dart.
I mean, they were very startling for people at the time because they came from the north and they were faintly Gothic and their pseudonyms made it seem as if it had been written by a man.
Yeah.
And they picked up lots of, you know, hot topics, even political topics of the time, like the status of women, the status of governesses, what you do with mad people.
Right, yeah.
You know, so there are all kinds of ways in which it connects with the news. I mean, even Charlotte Bronte's Shirley, even though it's set in, what is it, 1811, 1812, there are strikes and there's machine breaking in it. Mm. And that, of course, would have fitted, you know, very powerfully with the late 1840s and the, you know, the year of revolutions and so on. So there are ways in which it's really, it's full of very pressing issues. I suppose that the reason why I've always liked them, or my particular take on them, because I'm a romanticist, so I specialise really in the period just before this, you know, the romantic poets and essayists and, you know, the creatures of the imagination. I suppose what I always found amazing about the Brontes is the way in which they take all of that legacy of Byron and Coleridge and Wordsworth, and then they sort of inject it into the realist novel. So, you know, they grew up reading Byron, Walter Scott, and Tales of Terror from Blackwood's magazine. But when they apply it to their fiction, or when they start writing fiction, all of a sudden you get this amazing combination of incredibly sort of homespun settings, which are, you know, very real. Their sense of Yorkshire is incredibly real, alongside this extraordinary Gothic imagination, which they all sort of share to different degrees. Their careers were incredibly brief, but they were definitely a thing when they happened. Mm. I mean, I suppose one of the ways of sort of gauging that would be that there's a bit of a scandal even around Jane Eyre, because Charlotte has met and admired Thackeray. Mm. And she, is it Jane Eyre she dedicates to Thackeray, or maybe it's another one of those? I think it is Jane Eyre. But the scandal is that Thackeray has actually had his wife incarcerated, or has put her in an asylum.
Oh, really?
And then she dedicates Jane Eyre to him. And everybody thinks, oh gosh, well, she must be having an affair with him, because, you know, that's exactly what happens in Jane Eyre. The guy who's put his wife away ends up with a fancy new governess. You know, that's one of the things that made them particularly newsworthy, or made her particularly newsworthy at the time. There's a bit of sort of fake scandal about it. Wuthering Heights is just so extreme, you know, it's so, you know, it's so out there. I mean, in a good way.
I have an idea about what you mean by that, because I agree. I think it's probably the most original of the sisters' books. But what do you mean by that?
Well, I was reading all these in my late teens and early 20s, and I always struggled a bit with Wuthering Heights because everybody's so horrible to each other the whole time.
Yeah.
Even the dogs are nasty. And so I struggled to just get just a handle on it, really. And also, on first reading, it's a bit like 100 Years of Solitude as well, in the sense that all the characters seem to have the same names. So you have to, you know, you need to get a piece of paper so you can sort out all the Lintons and the Earnshaws and work out who's related to whom.
That is very true, yeah.
Yeah. So it took me a while, I think, to appreciate what was great about it. Whereas I mean, my experience with Jane Eyre was very different. I read that much earlier in my teens. I think my mum recommended it, and I was completely blown away and, you know, in love with Jane. And who kept telling me she wasn't pretty, but I didn't believe her. And so I mean, that was much easier to latch onto Charlotte's novels, I think.
Mm.
You know, which are, you know, very exciting, but they're also kind of funny. Whereas, you know, Wuthering Heights is quite grim. Really, I mean,
it's got a sort of good Yorkshire sarcasm to it, but you're right, it's not.
Do you feel that being a Yorkshireman? Do you?
I think so. Yeah,
because she does the dialect really well as well.
Yeah, she does,
because she knows it inside out, so she can do, you know, characters from every class. Yeah, and it's not overdone. Often in you know, in the fiction before that time, people who speak dialect, especially in novels, are servant characters who are funny, whereas you know, she's able to do it, and Charlotte. And Anne too, they're able to do characters of all classes that are kind of rounded. They've got a backstory and got motivation. You can kind of understand them.
You kind of imagine that all coming out of them sat around the fire as kids, can't you? Just messing around and putting on silly voices and pretending to be different characters.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know, the way that critics have tended to worry over them, let's say, is not too dissimilar in the way that critics have worried over Jane Austen. Is how could women with such restricted experience have written so brilliantly?
Obviously, witchcraft, I believe, is the only answer to that.
Yeah, that's, well, yeah, there is that. There are other rumours, yes. But no, it's quite extraordinary. And they really knew what they were writing about. I mean, in terms of setting, location, class, landscape, it's really quite amazing. I mean, it is difficult to put your finger on what you know. I mean, part of it is that they're the first to do certain kinds of narratives in certain kinds of ways. So, I mean, Jane Eyre is kind of the template for almost every romantic novel, Mills and Boone novel ever since. And but once something has emerged, you can look for the seeds before it and you realise that there are things that are moving towards this kind of production.
But
at the same time, that doesn't explain it. You can see the sort of where the Beatles might have come from in various ways, but there's still just the shock of it. And it's a bit similar with the Brontes, really, that they're quite extraordinary. So even though you see the various ways in which they pulled strands together, they're still, you know, very unique. And the simple shock of these three sisters having produced such fabulous fiction over such a short period of time, it still doesn't go away.
I'm wondering if that's the first time the Bronte sisters have been compared to the Beatles. I bet it's not, you know.
No, but it's not. We were talking about rock stars before.
There's parallels to be drawn there, isn't there? In Branwell, or Pete Best, as they call him, Branwell.
Poor
Branwell.
Yes, no, exactly. But I mean, to go back, I mean, the question about Wuthering Heights, I don't know, the way that I'd started beginning to feel that I'd got an understanding with it was to realise that it's kind of taking place in opposite world where everybody ends up being deliberately perverse. And so all those things which operate normally in another novel, like even Jane Eyre, where people try to be good, people, you know, look for tender passions, it just doesn't work. So,
yeah, it is morally really interesting, isn't it? It's kind of ahead of its time in a way, in that Emily doesn't seem interested in, you know, the idea of characters either being good or evil. She seems to be suggesting that everybody has the capacity for wildness and rage, but also, you know, mercy and kindness. It's almost a bit like she's comparing human nature to nature generally and saying sometimes it's stormy, sometimes it's calm. Well, that's what people are like as well. They're not good or evil. They're just, we're all just at the mercy of the elements almost.
And there's an unpredictability about it, but a sort of naked force about those gusts. I think if you start reading Wuthering Heights and you're expecting love to be a tender sentiment, you're going to be disappointed, because it's it seems to be more like a sort of function of the will, really, that it's kind of passion, which is also connected with identity and with a drive of the will. So, you know, Heathcliff and Cathy and even some of the other characters, what motivates them is just this, you know, strange kind of almost a survival impulse, or this strange self-destructive but also destructive kind of drive. That's what they pursue. That's what they obey. You know, you could call it, you know, it counts as love in the book, but it's not what you'd find in Jane Austen.
It's a funny kind of love.
It's a funny kind of love. That's right. Yeah.
Now, something John said earlier has been bothering me. That comment about us Brontes not being funny. I'll be honest, that annoyed me a bit. Be interesting to hear about that from someone a lot more intelligent, wouldn't it?
When Jane and Rochester get together, when Jane is working as, you know, kind of governess and tutor to his ward, and Rochester is ordering her about, but also kind of testing her, teasing her, and she stands up to him. You know, and what's astonishing about that is she's very lowly, she's very poor, and she's a servant in the household, but she's got a really strong sense of her own kind of spiritual equality, if you like. She's not cowed at any point. But she, you know, the novel also shows at that point that she's witty, you know, so they start to sound a bit like a kind of Shakespearean couple, a bit like Benedict and Beatrice. And, you know, that's quite funny. And, you know, there's some bizarre bits which are, you know, I don't know, the adaptations could try and milk the comedy of this, but where he is holding a party and bizarrely...
Oh, not the gypsy bit.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That is the weirdest bit of a book.
And I suppose it's a bit Emily-esque in the sense that it's about power, isn't it? She's kind of about a sort of power play. But once again, you know, Jane kind of passes all the tests. She's not cowed by this, having to go into a strange room with a cloaked gypsy to have her fortune told. Yeah, it's tricky about the Brontes and comedy? Because I suppose, I mean, they've been parodied many times, and you can see how, you know, some of the way in which the fiction is pitched wouldn't take much to take it into the realm of parody. But what's amazing about the writing is that it's not like you have to leave your sense of humour at the door, but that the writing is capable of keeping that pitch so that you read the novels in a state of kind of passionate and rapt attention. And you don't have to apologise for them. Or, you know, there are many other writers at the time who are more susceptible to being seen as ridiculous, as it were, at a distance of a distance of time, or in the, you know, in the wrong mood. Whereas there's something so passionately earnest about their writing. Are you worried by the supernatural elements, would you say?
I really enjoy them in Wuthering Heights. Yeah. There aren't any in Jane Eyre, are they? I can't really remember.
The thing about them is they mostly get explained. So they're not, yeah, they're not writing ghost fiction, but they're really interested in ghosts, possessions, entities, figures of the imagination. So,
yeah.
I mean, in Villette, there's a what appears to be a ghostly nun for a while haunting the school. But it turns out it's a bloke in disguise trying to see his girlfriend.
Another bloke in disguise.
Yeah. But there are, you know, the Kate Bush moment in Wuthering Heights. Again, the way that they handle those moments is quite extraordinary, because they have it both ways.
In what sense?
Well, Lockwood has picked up a book and has been reading Kathy's journal, you know, which is kind of scribbled in the margins of a book. And this is when he's staying the night at Wuthering Heights for the first time. And doesn't know anything about these people or the people that used to live there. And then he starts to get a bit curious about this Catherine, and he's sleeping in some little curtained area by the window. And he goes to sleep and has a nightmare, wakes up, goes to sleep again, has another nightmare. And this time it's the Kate Bush moment where there's a voice saying, "Let me in." And Lockwood shrieks, you know, because he ends up kind of grating the wrist of Kathy outside to get it to let go of him against the broken glass of the window. You know, it's quite graphic. And then he wakes up with his own scream, as it were, and Heathcliff comes into the room. And Mr. Lockwood then, and I think it's pretty clear, it's obvious it's a dream, but then Lockwood immediately kind of blames Heathcliff for having put him in what's clearly a haunted room.
Right.
And then they agree to swap rooms, and Lockwood goes to Heathcliff's room, and Heathcliff stays in the guest room, and Lockwood hears him make this cry, this appeal out of the window, and it's to Kathy. "Can you appear again? I want to see you again." So it's, you know, so he's obviously appeared to him before. And so you just get this wonderful, rich sense that no, we don't, nobody believes, don't believe in ghosts. There's always an explanation. And yet at the same time, we really do.
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose in Jane Eyre, you can see why, you know, people might still consider this to be the most romantic novel of all time, because the way in which it has a concept of a kind of romantic relationship between a man and a woman as a kind of absolute existential bond that's completely, you know, that's willed, that's deliberate, that's determined, that's kind of spiritual, really.
Yes.
Incredible spiritual intensity.
Yeah.
You know, that moment when she's just about maybe to marry the crazy missionary and then she hears this, she gets this kind of weird message.
Oh, yeah, she has a sort of mesmeric moment.
Yeah, text message from Rochester over the over the ether saying, Jane. To which she immediately replies, "Where are you? I'm coming." And, you know, what's strange about that is she tracks him down, goes back to Yorkshire, discovers his house is burnt down by his, you know, insane wife, and she adopts him, looks after him in his, you know, his kind of maimed state. But when they talk about it afterwards, he says, "Yeah, I heard your reply."
Oh, I've forgotten that. Right.
But then they both, because they're both kind of Anglicans and rational, they both agree that it's not supernatural at all. You know, it's just what happens when you're in tune. But there it is.
But we love all that stuff. That's good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think, you know, one explanation for it would be that, you know, that's the way they understand and are using the Gothic, that there are forms of emotional intensity, psychological investment, forms of passion, really, that realist fiction, that ordinary prose or ordinary plotting just can't fathom. And these things are real too. So you have to find a way to describe those things. They did have it particularly bad in a tough part of the world, but also, yeah, a family that was stricken by disease and so on. So, I mean, I guess one of the things that the Brontes are doing is they're telling that story in a way which is partly coming out of their own particular condition, but it's partly a more universal story than you might think. And I suppose one of the things that Jane Eyre is doing, which is also coming out of the Romantics, is also telling the story from the beginning, you know, seeing the childhood, the formative moments, the formative traumas as being crucial to understanding the, you know, the later adult. And again, that's quite new. And romantic, if you like. You know, that's one of the things that Wordsworth is doing in his poems, is, you know, encouraging people to think about people's visionary childhood, where you have these early, devastating, sometimes traumatic experience, visionary encounters with nature, and that they form the later being. And what the Brontes are, in a sense, doing is translating that into the fields of the novel. So what, you know, Cathy and Heathcliff encounter on the moors, or what Jane encounters in the Red Room, you know, it's coming out of a kind of romantic, poetic interest in childhood, but it's concrete settings, concrete material circumstances. You know, it's the novel.
Wow. Well, he was good, wasn't he? I'd probably bother listening to this podcast if he was the host. Oh, well. So, shall we find out where Rambling Tom and John have got to?
Just a few more bird noises, Tommy, before we move on. Well, that was nice, wasn't it, Tommy?
So I've had a little pub lunch.
Yeah.
Reinvigorated.
Much better now.
By the power of pub chips.
Yeah.
And now we're going to Haworth.
Home of tea shops, the Bronte sisters. What else, Tommy?
And, well, the parsonage is where we're going to go, isn't it?
It is. The Bronte's parsonage. Where the Brontes grew up, of course. Lived and died.
So that was actually their house.
Yeah. Anyway, hopefully we'll get more information there.
Yes.
They're going home. I haven't been home for over 150 years. Bit nervous, to be honest. Let's just hope they don't get distracted on the way this time.
Exciting news. Mm-hmm. We've just found the world's largest bush.
It is massive.
Haven't we, Tommy?
You get a picture of it?
It's a little bit freaky.
I'm going to put that on the blog.
Yeah, it's the world's largest rhododendron bush.
It is. It says, there's a sign that says, caution, stay clear, invasive rhododendron.
What's it invading?
I don't know, but maybe it's just slowly
taking over the earth. It is incredible. It's a beautiful, massive, now slightly frightening thing. Now we've read the sign.
Yeah, who cordons off a bush? It's just weird.
Well, when it gets that big, Tom.
When it's invasive.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was about to take the piss, but in fairness, that was some magnificent shrubbery. It's funny though, you know. My stomach feels all fluttery at the thought of going home. Oh, wait. Goodness, look. They've arrived in Haworth. They're on Church Street. They're walking up the path towards the parsonage.
Hello. How are you doing? You're not Lizzie, are you?
No, Lizzie.
Ah, she's just in here.
The next one along.
All right, brilliant. Okay. We'll keep moving then.
Thank you.
Look at that. It looks just the same.
Thank you. Hello, are you Lizzie?
I am.
Hi, Lizzie.
Oh, my gosh, I totally forgot about this.
Don't worry. Is it okay?
So this is our exhibition space. So this was added, obviously, after the Bronte period. And it holds a lot of our items that it doesn't sort of...
It would be weird if the Brontes had all this stuff in little glass cases.
Yeah,
it would
exactly.
be slightly self. So, what do you have in here? What are your prize possessions in here?
So, the one that I would say is supposed to be is number 5 here. So, this is a little book that Charlotte wrote when she was very young. And this is a new acquisition that we got only just a couple of months ago. And it's part of a 12-part series, and it's books that they wrote when they were children. And they were little books, and you can see how tiny the writing is.
Is this the Glass Town or whatever? Is it that's
similar, but Glass Town was one of their imaginary worlds, and Agria is another one. But it's part of a young men's magazine that they created, with inspired by certain characters. And they wrote, can you see how tiny, tiny, teeny, weeny the writing is?
Yeah, what good eyes.
It's crazy, isn't it?
How did they even...
So, I mean, if you come over this side, you can just see from the magnifying glass. And the reason why it was so small was paper was expensive.
Yeah.
So they didn't have a lot of resources. But they also had a bit of a secret language with their siblings. Okay. So you know, like when you're younger,
your
siblings have like code words that your parents don't know. It was kind of like that. So Mr. Bronte had very bad eyesight anyway.
So the small writing
was to us, so to keep it secret away from Mr. Bronte's
So where did that turn up then, if that's been recently?
It turned up in New York.
Of course it did.
It went missing in the 1960s, I think.
Wow.
And no one knew where it was. It was assumed that it was in private hands, and it appeared an auction house. And it was actually purchased by Friends of National Libraries, I think.
Right.
And guess how much it was?
Definitely over a grand.
Just a bit.
Yeah.
So it was $1.2 million.
Yes. Wow. Okay. See why it's behind glass now.
Yeah, and I think it's the highest selling female author's writing of all time.
And that's something
that
book.
She wrote. Exactly, it's just something she scribbled when she was...
When she was how old?
Just, I think she was 12, potentially.
You'd love
12,
to be able
13.
To go back in time and say...
Yeah. Hey Charlotte.
Did you know how much that's going to sell?
You won't believe this, but yeah.
Wow.
So that's one of my favourites, and it is one that, you know, people come to the museum and say, have you got the little books?
Yeah.
And we've got quite a few others as well now. So I think we're nearly at the full, if not the full collection of little books now.
Wow.
Which is really special.
Yeah, amazing. And this is how they cut their teeth, really.
Yes.
As writers.
Absolutely, yeah.
Have you ever actually read any of the...
These,
like the really early, what do you call it, juvenilia? Really?
Juvenilia, yeah. I've not read any of the, there are quite a few that have been translated, and you can read some of the juvenilia. I've not read any of these, but Anne, who's our head curator, is in the process of transcribing a lot of these.
Right.
So we've just had some new manuscripts as well come, and she's in the process of sort of understanding what they all are. Wow. But they're very special.
It would be interesting to see the content, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Are they any good or not?
A bit rubbish.
Those kind of seeds of what came later versus thinking it is.
So true. It said that Emily was just kind of lost within that world for the majority of her life.
Wow.
Whereas Charlotte was kind of moved on and was a little bit more mature and moved on to more sort of themes based around society at the time. Emily was still kind of stuck in that imaginary space. And her poetry as well. I think there's a lot of similarities between her poetry and her childhood work, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And they were big readers as well.
What's your understanding of what they were like as
it's
people?
So interesting because it differs who you ask. In the museum, in my opinion, and we all have our favourites, unfortunately.
And
it's hard not
yours.
To. So my favourite is Emily.
Hey, get in. I knew I liked this Lizzie laugh.
Because she was a wild, free spirit. I love Emily. She was definitely a homebody. So she went to school with Charlotte, and then she tried to be a teacher at Law Hill School in Halifax.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it was just not the place for her. She came back very slim, very grey, very unhappy. Outside of the parsonage was not her sort of place.
Yeah,
she felt safest and happiest in the house and on the moors.
Mm.
And I get that. I also feel happy at home and on the moors. she seeked a lot of her inspiration just from her own head, and I love that. There's a new film about Emily, and she has this incredible romance in the film.
With whom?
An assistant curate at the church, who was a real person.
Right. Well, okay.
And he actually sent a
Valentine's. Did like the curates, didn't they?
They had a tag, and her eye turned slightly, didn't she? Yeah, she was also same person.
Oh, okay.
Same guy, So they all had a little bit of an eye for Waitman. And he actually sent them a Valentine's Day card. All three of them.
Wow, what a player.
Right?
I mean, play the numbers, right? So it's a numbers game.
So they were all badly in love with him, I'm sure. But, in the film, it's actually Emily who has the love affair with Waitman. But in real life, as far as we know, Emily never had a love interest. But people sort of expect that she did because Wuthering Heights is so dark.
Passionate.
So passionate. Yeah. And how can you conjure that from just your imagination? But she was just that imaginative.
Ah, thanks, Lizzie. Oh, to be in love. What do you reckon the truth is? Guess we'll never know, will we?
What else have you got that's a favourite?
I mean, I'm a bit morbid, so I quite like this
Great.
Bit.
Oh, the funereal case.
Yeah. So, God, yeah, I'm terrible. But the a lot of interest as well people have when they come to the museum is not only about the family, but as Haworth and how it was to live in Haworth at the time. And people imagine it to be just as beautiful and sort of chocolate box as it is now.
Yeah.
But in fact, it was a very, very bad place to live in terms of sanitation, death rates. So this case is a stark reminder of what it was actually like to live here. There's a ring here that's one of my favourite pieces. It's number 8. It's a mourning ring. And then number 7 there is actually a piece of jewellery, and it was a common Victorian custom to make jewellery out of the deceased person's hair.
Oh, that's lovely.
Isn't that nice? So that's actually... Number 7 is
Oh, it's hair. Like a lock.
It's like braided. Locket, yeah, with a locket there, but the actual piece around is...
Oh, you're kidding.
Braids. And we also have another necklace in storage, which is just a necklace of braided hair.
So that is actually there?
Someone's hair. I can't remember whose that person's are.
And it belonged to...
Made with the hair of Emily and Anne.
Wow. So who had it made?
Arthur Bell Nichols. Presumably it might have been Arthur, or it might have been Mr. Bronte.
Right. Who was Arthur?
So Arthur Bell Nichols was, again, the assistant curate for Mr. Bronte.
Of course he was.
And he ended up marrying Charlotte. So she was the only one out of the sisters to marry. Right. She was actually in early stages of pregnancy when she died. Right. But unfortunately, she was so sick with hyperemesis gravidarium, and it's a severe sickness in pregnancy. And it's still quite common today, but we can get treatment for it now.
Yeah.
But she was very dehydrated and caused her timely demise. So yes, unfortunately, there's no descendants. Technically, there are no descendants.
Oh,
there's a juicy story. So obviously, you've heard. I'm assuming you've heard that Brownwell was quite a live liar.
Yeah.
There is a rumor that he had a child with one of the servants, an assistant curate. Believe it or not, not this
Must
one. Yes, so apparently he had a child with someone, and there is a descendant of that child that has come forward and said, I am a descendant of Brownwell Bronte, but will not do any DNA. So, and we have plenty of it. We've literally got hair.
Well,
so.
Ah, more myths and rumours. I suppose you'd like me to spill the beans, finally, about whether that whole Brownwell thing is true or a big stripy lie. Well, I'm not going to, so there. I wonder what people think of my brother now.
Did he ever write anything of any...
Of any merit? Probably not. So he did... His first sort of focus was he wanted to be a writer. And he had some poetry published in a Halifax newspaper. That's as far as that got. Then he wanted to be a painter. So he had some lessons and he wanted to be a portrait artist. These three paintings were painted by Branwell.
Oh, right. Okay.
The famous pillar portrait of the three sisters with him painted out was Branwell's. So he was good.
Yeah.
And he was supposed to go for an audition at an art school, but didn't go.
Oh, okay.
Whether he bottled out of it, I don't really know.
Or just got too drunk.
Could be that. yeah, probably that.
What was the reason he painted himself out, that picture?
We don't know. And it's a mystery.
It's. How would you?
It's a very boring explanation, but he painted that when he was only 17, so it was very, very early on in his sort of painting career. It's really difficult to paint yourself, whereas the wood paint from reference was a lot easier. Yeah. So he'd get his sisters to sit and he could paint them. When it came his turn to paint himself in, that was difficult, most likely.
You're saying it was probably a bit rubbish.
He was probably a bit like, that looks a bit rubbish.
Yeah, they look all
Let's
right,
just scribble myself it. Out. So you can literally see when they've done like scannings of the picture, he didn't even get as far as putting like details on his face.
Oh, so just get the tip X out.
Yeah.
I've ruined it.
Yeah. He's got like a white cravat on and there's like the shape of his curly hair. That's as far as it goes. Then he puts the pillar over it. Over time, in the National Portrait Gallery, the paint fades, the pillar fades, and all of a sudden this ghostly figure of Branwell appears.
It's cool.
Yeah, it's quite a sombre picture,
isn't it?
It's
pretty,
and now we know what we know about Branwell and how his end kind of came. It's so scary. It's a very, very creepy feeling, that portrait.
Ah, Branwell. Dear Branwell. You never really got a chance to prove yourself, did you? What a bloody mess it all was in the end.
But because Branwell wasn't the most reliable person,
and probably wouldn't have been able to look after his three siblings. There was a big push for them to support themselves financially. So they did teach, they were governesses, and Charlotte did earn a nice bit of money from Jane Eyre. A set fee of about £600 for Jane Eyre, and that was it.
And what would that be in modern terms?
I've not a clue.
We'll find out.
Someone Google that.
We'll edit that in.
£600 in the 1830s, that was decent money. Roughly £100,000 today.
Well, that's quite a lot, isn't
that
it?
That is so much.
In today's money, that's a lot of money, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's interesting because we have some dresses in the collection, and you can literally tell from the period of dress when she became famous.
Right.
Because this one particular dress that's striped and it has like real dried flowers on all the way down, and it's beautiful, and it's something that you definitely would not wear in Haworth. So you could tell that that's... Yeah, it'd be a nightmare. So that's what she would wear when she... It's a London dress.
So in what order... This is morbid as well, sorry. In what order... It feels like I should have like a little game show.
When? Of what order? So if you're going to go way back, so it's Mrs. Bronte, the mother.
Yeah.
The two eldest, Mariah and Elizabeth. People don't really know much about.
How old did they live till?
10 and 11.
Oh, they lived that long?
Yeah.
So I thought they were tiny.
Tiny, teeny, weeny, no. Yeah. Wow. They all were at a school for parsons' daughters, and it was kind of like the school in Jane Eyre, and that's where Charlotte got her inspiration for the school.
Bad.
Yeah. And it was very poor conditions, bad food, and they caught TB.
Oh, my God.
So they came home, but unfortunately, Elizabeth and Maria passed away. And then it was Bramwell, Emily, Anne. Give it a few years, Charlotte gets married, then Charlotte at the end.
I feel like it should be a easy to remember rhyme.
Like Henry the Sixth's
wives. Yeah, yeah. Mum and Maria and Lizzie was next. Sorry, man. We'll work on that. We'll do that. Yeah,
yeah, we'll you, please send it to us.
We'll do that in song.
Mrs. Maria Bronte expired in 1821. Living in Yorkshire then was torture, not a lot of fun. Next up to heaven, aged 11, her namesake Maria. In 1825 she said farewell and then retired. 6 weeks later saw the fate of young Elizabeth. Came home from cruel Cowanbridge School and took her final breath. Next was the son at 31, snuffed out like a candle. In 1848 it was too late for poor old Branwell. Sister Emily, next of the family, raised to Wuthering Heights. 3 months on, she too had gone and passed towards the light. And too young, her labouring lungs were struggling to function. Her dad's worst fear the following year, taken by consumption. Charlotte's fate at 38, at the height of her writing power. With doting lover and bun in the oven, she reached a final hour. Despite the shock, the tick of the clock, and death's literary hat trick. Aged 84, outliving them all, was dear old Father Patrick.
They're the real thing. They're neat whiskey. They're not. There's no dilution or anything. It's heady stuff.
That's good. That's going in, by the way, Greg. Like that.
Yeah, there should be a Bronte cocktail. You can probably only take about one per evening because it'll knock you out. But so heady, so intense. But yeah, definitely.
Well, babushkas, I suppose on that note, I should probably head off. Get running up that hill. Maybe I'll see you up there on the moors. It's true what John said. There've been folk who've sworn they've seen the strange phenomena of a woman in a bonnet and a gown stalking the countryside around Haworth. And honestly, I can't recommend it enough. A little wander up into those beautiful, brutal moors for some moments of pleasure. I'm happiest when most away. I can bear my soul from its home of clay. On a windy night when the moon is bright and the eye can wander through worlds of light. When I am not and none beside, nor earth, nor sea, nor cloudless sky, but only spirit wandering wide through infinite immensity.
Wow. By the fireplace stands the rocking chair where Anne would sit with her feet on the fender. And it is believed that Emily died on the sofa in this room.